Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Nom nom.
You are listening to Kubernetes Bytes, a podcast bringing you the latest from the world of cloud-native data management. My name is Ryan Wallner, and I'm joined by Bhavin Shah, coming to you from Boston, Massachusetts. We'll be sharing our thoughts on recent cloud-native news and talking to industry experts about their experiences and challenges managing the wealth of data in today's cloud-native ecosystem.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are. We're coming to you from Boston, Massachusetts. Today is August 31st, 2023. I hope everyone is doing well and staying safe. Let's dive into it. I know it's still August. It's the last day of August, and it feels kind of like fall outside.
I know, the temperature has definitely gone down, which this is perfect temperature for me. Like, I don't want it in the 90s and 100s. I don't want it in the 40s. So, like, as long as it's between that 50 and 70 range, perfect for me.
Yeah, if it could be like this all year round,
I know.
I'd be pumped. I mean, I know it's still like 115 in Phoenix right now, so I feel for those people, but or in Texas. But hey, you know, we chose 3 feet of snow in the winter. You chose that. You know, we all have our gripes about where we live. what have you been up to this past weekend and stuff, Bhavin?
I don't know. I went to a conference in Vegas, VMware Explore, last week. So I was out there.
Yeah. How was that?
It was good. I didn't go in with a lot of expectations. Like, personally, I feel that that audience still is a lot of like legacy virtualization admins that want to talk about like running VMs. So, but I was surprised. Like, I did have more conversations than I expected when at that show about Kubernetes and about like data on Kubernetes and things like that. So overall, a good show. Not as
Where was that? Is that Vegas?
Yeah, it was. So another Vegas trip. Two into one, I think.
I'm not going to be at reInvent this year, which I I'm not terribly mad about.
I think I'm somewhere there too. Like, I think, maybe I'm not on the list, but we'll see. It's still far out.
I mean, people love Vegas and power to them, but
Not me.
It's not my jam.
I know.
It's not my jam. If I just venture outside of Vegas and you get me into like Grand Canyon and that kind of stuff, that's my jam.
Not in summer though, right? Like 150 degrees. Not
in summer. I've been there in summer. I've been there when it's 150 degrees. Hiking in the Grand Canyon, actually.
Not fun.
You know, as long as you make sure to drink water and not soda, you won't have to get helicoptered out. Speaking of a friend's experience. Anyway, so I know I texted you over the weekend because I was in Chinatown.
I know. Come on, dude. Like, give me some heads up.
Well, I was in there and I was like, oh, I should let Bhavin know I'm here because a buddy of mine, we were going to some like whiskeys of the world.
Oh, nice.
Thing at the Continental, and which was great. And I'm like, I like bourbons and stuff like that, but it's not like my thing. But I did find one I really enjoyed. But we went in the day because it was beautiful.
Yeah.
And I haven't been to Chinatown in a while. So I was like, I got to go to a few of these places.
Get some ramen
there either.
Yeah.
Oh, we didn't go ramen. We went dumplings and shumai and all these things. You know, those places like Windsor Dumpling in Boston. Yeah. You sit at shared tables and you just put check boxes with the stuff you want. With dangerous, by the way, because you just keep it coming, you know. And then we were walking towards the north end and I was like, I wonder if Bhavin's around. But that was nice. It was a beautiful day out. So I couldn't complain, which is a pretty good weekend.
And we have the long weekend coming up, so perfect.
We do. Do you have off tomorrow too, or just the Monday?
Just the Monday.
My father has off like tomorrow and Monday and Tuesday. I was like, I need to get your manager.
I know. That's awesome.
No gripe to my manager if you're listening out there, by the way.
Or maybe this is the push he needs, Ryan.
All right. Well, so we have a really cool topic today. We're going to be talking about CubeSlice with Rob. We'll give you a little more about him. But before we dive into that, networking world. Let's do a little bit of news. Bhavan, why don't you kick us off?
Yeah, sure. So Google Cloud Next is this week, right? And they did, following their Google I.O. announcement, the first keynote was all AI, 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 AI. I think they also have a AI session in the catalog with just...
I get an AI.
Yeah. But they introduced something called Duet AI in Google Cloud. And it definitely has a component where it works with Google Workspaces and helps you do Google Sheets and Google Docs better. But then from a Google Cloud perspective and the app modernization space that we work with usually, it can help you modernize your applications, right? So you can just tell it like, okay, this is my C++ app or this is my C++ function. Please rewrite it in Go and make sure that instead of using a local DB, I use Cloud SQL. Again, this is trying to move applications to their cloud, but it just does all of that and rewrites your code, gives you a new Go app or Go function. And you can start using cloud databases. So I think that was pretty cool, like the demo that I saw during the keynote. So I just wanted to share
that. Is that scary, though? Is that replacing someone's job?
It is, but...
It's borderline replacing someone's job.
Like, you still need people who can understand Go to verify that what AI has written is actually correct and what you want to do. So there still needs to be barriers and, I don't know, tests written and made sure that the functionality is the same, but at least it removes some of the heavy lifting.
I feel like this is one of those turtles all the way down. This is when we're going to have AI verifying the AI output.
Yeah. And then
it just keeps turtles.
That's it. Some AI has to keep the other AI honest, right? Like,
awesome. Well, that's cool. That's good stuff.
And it can also help developers who don't want to spend time or learn to write complex SQL queries.
Get more done. Yep, that's another way to look at it.
Yeah. they can just ask like in natural language, like just generate a query that gives me X, Y, and Z from this table and join that table with it. And then it just gives everything in a proper query format. So that was cool too.
That's fair.
Yeah. So those were a couple of announcements. I know, and then moving on, I think I saw KubeCost Cloud, and we have spoken to the KubeCost guys.
Yeah.
We have spoken about how KubeCost Cloud was in beta. Now it's GA, finally. So you can now install it using a simple Helm chart on your Kubernetes clusters, AKS, GKE, EKS, I think, and get everything integrated into one unified portal and manage your costs from that single pane of glass. So that's a cool thing to check out. They do have a free trial. And then KEDA, right? When we did the whole serverless approach, I spent some time like researching more about KEDA and understanding how the event-driven autoscaler works. That project inside CNCF has now moved to a graduated state. So it's now a graduated CNCF project for people who are keeping track at home, I guess, of CNCF projects. But yeah, that's a quick news section for me.
Awesome. I just have a few here. The first one is around what NetApp's up to in Google Cloud. So they have offered basically a first party managed file store service built into Google Cloud now. So I think this was announced at Google Cloud Next, I believe, to GA. So I think it's been around, but this is Google Cloud NetApp, Google Cloud NetApp Volumes.
Nice.
For some buzzword bingo there. But this is all about the network file system support across those platforms. And they have some other stuff in that announcement around, you know, using the right types of storage for a lot of these AI workloads.
Okay.
If it's, you know, the reality is most announcements will try to mention the word AI at some point. It is centered around that.
Funny thing is every conference will try to get the NVIDIA CEO Jensen on the keynote stage. Like VMware did it last week. Google Cloud did it this week.
He's a popular guy.
Yeah. Like we need some AI, some NVIDIA in our keynote to boost our stock price up, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. One fun fact.
Well, yeah, all this stuff is still powered by... their ONTAP operating system. So all the things you'd normally get like snapshots and replication and stuff should be all familiar, but now it is effectively GA and available for you to use.
Nice. A fun fact about that. One second. I used to work at NetApp, right? So the NetApp CEO.
You did?
Yeah, I did. the NetApp CEO and the Google Cloud CEO are actually twin brothers, like identical twin brothers.
Identical twins. Well, that is funny. I didn't think I knew that.
Yeah. So just a fun fact.
in your technology bingo, wherever you play at your next local brewery, you'll have that one in your pocket.
Yeah. Trivia night.
Successful family there.
Yep.
Okay, so the next one I had was around GKE Enterprise. Yeah. So Google obviously launched Kubernetes way back in the day. I shouldn't say way back in the day, about 10 years ago,
yeah,
or less. And they've had obviously their GKE offering for quite some time. But this newest announcement is really around GKE Enterprise, which builds on top of everything they've done with things like Anthos and GKE, yeah, and everything. And it really is, I think, aimed at managing more complexity of multiple clusters, yeah, whether that's GKE clusters and Anthos clusters and things like that. So it ties in security and governance and all these things. So it's kind of a level up to, yeah, you know, I don't know, Charizard, if you're into that kind of thing, leveling up their service.
It was weird when, like, the first line in that blog post was, oh, GKE Enterprise is the premium edition of GKE. And my mind went to, like, why isn't GKE the premium edition of GKE?
Why isn't it premium? Well, we had to give the new thing a new name.
Yeah. So it is multi-cluster. But, like, they have a concept called fleets, and you can manage multiple clusters easily and exactly, things like that. So,
yeah. And we're going to talk about this, yeah, hopefully today a little bit around, and we have been talking about it with previous guests. And now I think the whole industry as an entirety,
yeah,
is moving towards those more complex, how do you do things, multi-cloud, multi-cluster, yeah, those kind of things. So not too surprising that they're centering in on this and along with other companies. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, it's called GKE Enterprise. I've always been a fan of GKE stuff. So nice. I'm sure it's some good stuff. Good. We'll have all these links in the show notes if you want to go dig into it some more. I have a couple others that I haven't mentioned. I won't go into them, but one's, mm-hmm, an article about API gateways. If you're new to API gateways and what they're about and how they work, there's cool one there. Yeah. And then one on ngrok static domains. If you're a fan of ngrok like I am, about publishing some stuff you're working on locally, you can have your own static domain now for free.
Nice.
So you can name it. I don't know what you can name it, but maybe something identifiable, which is nice. You can always go back to the same place instead, yeah, of randomly generated stuff. So go check those two articles out as well. All right. So today we have Rob Courteau from Visha. He kind of manages director of growth over there, and he's here to talk to us about KubeSlice, which is an open source project they have surrounding, what do you know, multi-cloud, multi-cluster networking and connectivity. Without further ado, let's get Rob on the show.
As longtime listeners of the Kubernetes Bytes podcast know, I like to visit different national parks and go on day hikes. As part of these hikes, it's always necessary to hydrate during and after it's done. This is where our next sponsor comes in, Liquid IV. I've been using Liquid IV since last year on all of my national park trips, because it's really easy to carry and I don't have to worry about buying and carrying Gatorade bottles with me. A single stick of Liquid IV in 16 ounces of water hydrates 2 times faster than water and has more electrolytes than ever. The best part is I can choose my own flavor. Personally, I like passion fruit, but they have 12 different options available. If you want to change the way you hydrate when you're outside, you can get 20% off when you go to liquidiv.com and use code KubernetesBytes at checkout. That's 20% off anything you order when you shop Better Hydration today using promo code KubernetesBytes at liquidiv.com.
All right. Welcome to Kubernetes Bytes, Rob. It's great to have you here. We're going to talk all things Kubernetes and networking, hopefully. But before we jump into all those questions we have for you, please introduce yourself to everyone, yeah, and what you do.
Great. Thanks for having me. So my name is Rob Courteau. I'm the Director of Enablement at Avisha. And I basically help our customers understand and maximize the potential of using our products for their Kubernetes ecosystems.
Very, very cool. So you work for Avisha, and today we're going to talk a lot about sort of what KubeSlice is. So give us a brief introduction about what that project's all about and really what challenges are out there today around it.
Yeah, so KubeSlice is one of our flagship products, and it simplifies cross-cluster communications, mm-hmm, either in a hybrid environment across multiple clouds, or if you're in a single cloud, across regions. So we're able to do that seamlessly. And what the real nut of the product is, the communication between those different clusters, it's done seamlessly. We can get that up and running in, you know, 10, 15 minutes, and you have that cluster connectivity.
Very cool. Yeah, I know multi-cloud, multi-cluster are hot topics this year. I think they'll be hot topics going into 2024 as well. Yep. I think more people, as they run Kubernetes, are like, how do I do this more than once and in different places?
Even more so than that, like I've come across with a lot of the customers where I just talked to one yesterday, and he's like, hey, we were trying to figure out how to do this in-house.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, the table is starting to turn. Because back when we all started containers, we're like, hey, I'm going to containerize my application because then I can run it anywhere. Right. And then we're like, well, yeah, I can't really run it anywhere. I can, but in pockets. The need now for those corporations and the enterprises that really want to have that those disparate clouds and not be vendor locked in and really deploy their applications anywhere. Let's just take like a DR scenario, right? They they want to have something running in Azure and something running in AWS. And it's very difficult to do that today, networking wise and Kubernetes wise. So our whole goal was to simplify that. And that's exactly what KubeSlice does. So you're able to connect those two clusters and then deploy the workloads or the microservices where it makes sense across those cloud providers. Or if it's a DR scenario, right? Just keep it as a warm standby. If something happens in AWS, just flip the switch and you're over in Azure and your customers are none the wiser.
Absolutely. So, and we'll get in some use cases, but KubeSlice is open source. Has it always been open source?
When we first started, it was not.
Okay. So what was that? Like, why was the choice to open source it?
Yeah. So we really wanted to harness the power of the community, not only give back. So when we were developing KubeSlice, we were following close with the CNCF, SIG multi-cluster group, just to make sure that we're in line with what the community is looking for. So we took pieces of KubeSlice, not the whole thing, right? We took the connectivity piece of it and then open sourced that out to the community. So we really want to, you know, obviously enable the developers, any DevOps teams out there, the community, you know, the Kubernetes community as a whole, because, you know, we all take from it anyways. So, you know, we want to be good stewards.
Good citizens, yep.
You contribute back, right?
Absolutely.
That's awesome.
You know, and it gives like those younger developers that are coming into the space a new project to work on, right?
No, that's a good reason, right? Like building community and just making sure people have the tools and technology to
and make it
complex setups.
And it's great. Like we don't want to develop in a vacuum, right? Yeah. Oh, I think the customers want this. So by giving it out to the developers, they've got their own little unique use cases, and you know, those commits and PRs will help us just grow the platform.
For sure. Absolutely. So, like, I want to focus on the hybrid cloud, multi-cloud story, right? Like, speaking from my past terrible experiences, I've configured, like, a Cisco ASR router on-prem to talk to, like, a Cisco CSR instance in the cloud and establish a VPN. And that's, like, really difficult and really tedious. Like, okay, so I'm sure that's one of the challenges that KubeSlice is solving for with the whole cross-cloud thing, but can you talk a bit more about like just the general challenges that you see, right, when you're talking to customers that want to adopt such an architecture?
Yeah, sure. And I can just give you some of my own previous experience
outside
of our customers today. So prior to joining Avisha, I was at a consulting company called Taos, and they were bought by IBM.
Okay.
And one of the things I did there was I led the Google practice. So part of my consulting pieces on the Google side was really to get those Google customers onto Anthos. And so I started the Anthos practice there, and just exactly what you said there, just me getting it set up in my lab of just getting Anthos up, right? Just getting the developer workstations in place, doing that connectivity. I could only work with the F5s. If I was deploying it on VMware, I had to use the Seesaw load balancer. And they're like, well, if you've got PANs or anything else, like, you know, you're on your own, you got to kind of figure that out. Sure. And so once we did all that, part of the practice, the big part of the professional services is going into the customer site and doing IP mapping and management from day one. That is really the bulk of it. So depending on, like, if you're a huge enterprise, you could have thousands of, depending on your account strategy, let's take AWS, right? You could have thousands of accounts. Every developer has their own AWS account, how those systems talk to each other. Now you've got STS gateways, you got a routing nightmare. You've got it all. And then if you're trying to connect, say, from developer one's account to developers two, and they want some services to talk, well, you can't really do that, right? If you have the IP overlap, right? So maybe in that case, like a lot of customers just stick with the 10.0 and they just give everybody the default 10.0 and that's it. And so when you get into that, those sticky situations, it's a nightmare, and it just takes months to just untangle that and plan for it before you even do any type of connectivity between the clusters or workloads.
Yeah. And you're talking about like the how organizations are distributing these CIDR ranges, but even inside Kubernetes, right? Like inside a specific cluster, I know initially I used to have like a specific parameter CIDR range when I used kubeadm, but now I no longer do that. It's just whatever Kubernetes gives me by default. And obviously that will create the overlap in IP spaces. And then, yeah, it's not fun when you have same ranges across two different clusters trying to talk to each other. And agreed. So no, I'm glad that we have a solution like KubeSlice that's open source that can help us solve that. Do you want to talk about like how KubeSlice actually does this?
Yeah, I certainly can. Yeah. So what KubeSlice does, and let me just explain the slice just for the audience so they understand
it's
the construct.
We'll start with that.
It is not a pizza. So let's say we have three clusters, one in each major cloud provider, right? We've got one in AWS, Azure, and Google. And so the concept of the slice is being able to take resources from all those clusters and create a virtual cluster, if you will, mm-hmm. across all three physical clusters into different cloud environments. And that encapsulates a slice. You onboard your application onto that slice. Underneath, it doesn't know what's going on. And the mechanics behind it is we label some of the nodes. You can create your own node group if you want for the gateways, but you just have to label one of the nodes in each of the cluster. And that's when we do the Helm install where the bits get installed. Gotcha. So when we install the bits, we create a point-to-point VPN tunnel automatically between all the clusters that are engaged. And so every slice has its own router, its own DNS. It's isolated. The application is isolated. So the connectivity is per slice. And we handle that. We handle the certificates. We handle the service imports and exports across the clusters so they're aware. We handle the namespace sameness across all those different clusters. So from the app level, if you're looking at it from a platform team's point of view, mm-hmm. they can put the resources wherever they want and just give that slice to the developer, let them deploy their application, and that's all they need to do. And all that traffic, I know there's another question maybe around this, but the traffic itself is layer 3. Okay. East to west across all those clusters. There's no need, unless the application requires it, right? There's no need for a separate ingress for those services to talk now.
Okay, that makes it really easy because like ingress endpoints are great, but yeah, it's an additional resource that you have to develop and manage on top of your clusters.
Yes.
Yeah.
Correct.
It's funny. This brings me back. When I first got into just this industry as a whole, like coming out of school, I was working on Open vSwitch, and I was like working in the OpenFlow like lab where we were testing switches and all these things. But I remember specifically a little later on when Docker first got announced, some of the, I forget which startup it was, who got bought by Docker back in the day, they developed this basically overlay technology where you could just create an overlay network within Docker and Swarm, and it would just kind of, you could assign whatever, you know, setter address you wanted, and it would just be like poof, you could use the same one over and over again. And I was like, this is magic, right?
Yeah.
I think a lot of the power is kind of, you have your own little space, everything can communicate onto it, and now being able to do this kind of across clouds is really powerful. And I guess the question that comes up when you were talking about that is, you know, do the end users need to be aware of anything, any requirements between those, right? So are there latency, you know, constraints or requirements that the people need to be aware of? Like, what does that look like cross region and cloud?
Yeah, they don't really.
Okay.
It doesn't even come into play, right? Because it's not going all. If this was the typical cloud networking where we, let's say AWS, and we're getting the STS gateways, and we had to figure out where we're going to route it through. There's another management network. We don't need to because it's point to point. So the latency between the two clusters is very minimal.
Got it.
Okay. Okay. That's awesome. Like, hopefully this helps users that, I don't know, by mistake, keep their Kube API server exposed to the public. So making sure that this doesn't require any public connection definitely helps.
Yes. And the other piece I just want to tack on to that, because you mentioned it too, Ryan, is that CIDR address, the overlapping CIDR address. So in the slice construct, because it's isolated, let's say you were constrained with your IP space itself, mm-hmm. and you only had a few CIDR blocks that you could carve out. So we could take the same RFC 19 address, whether it's 192.10, what have you, /16, and you could reuse that same CIDR on multiple slices.
Oh, nice. Okay.
You could have 10 slices across those same three clusters using the same CIDR, and they never will conflict.
Yeah, that's very powerful.
I know. That's awesome.
Well, okay. So before we go into more of those nitty-gritty details, which I do want to get into, I think I want to go back to a little bit of the use cases again, right? So communication across region, cloud, those kind of, or cluster, that makes sense. But there's also one that we've talked about, Bob, and with previous guests, is how teams do migration, both from, we've done this from sort of a storage capacity, but also just from like, you know, I'm a team developing things on-prem, I'm using Kubernetes, but now I want to start using cloud, or maybe they're moving off cloud. How does this come into play when you're kind of crossing that chasm of on-prem to cloud, and what does that migration look like in this world?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And it's one I get asked all the time. It's actually the use case I lead into with customers.
Oh, cool.
Now, having mentioned that I was at the Taos practice, this was one of the things I had to do all the time, right? Cloud migrations from on-prem into the cloud. And so I had a large online, not a retailer, but a vacation travel kind of site, right? And they had a bunch of Kubernetes clusters on-prem. We were building their landing zone in Google, creating some GKE clusters. And they're like, hey guys, when can we get these clusters? Because, you know, we've got to fix our pipelines. We've got to, you know, do some massaging in the back. And like, well, guys, you know, we got to build a platform, right? So we have to do all the routing. We have to work with your network guys to get the PGP tunnels set up between Megaport and your on-premise and all that. And that's weeks, right? It's weeks worth of time. So had I had this software, we could have just connected the two still while we were doing the platform stuff, right? Because it's a point-to-point connectivity, at least for them to provide them a test bed. So they can set up all the ancillary things that they need to do in the meantime. So that's one half of that use case. The second half, let's just say that the foundation was already built. Yep. Now it's just me connecting those two clusters together, or three or five or whatever the case may be, and redeploying my app onto the slice and splitting the microservices wherever I wanted them. Mm-hmm. So if I had 15 microservices, I had three clusters, and it made sense to split them into fives, so whatever the case may be. I can put five on a AWS, five on Azure, and five on Google, and it would make no difference to the end customer. And that's how I demo it too when I demo to customers. I use Google's online boutique. It's got 12 microservices. Mm-hmm. I sprinkle them all around. We go through the front interface. So I make, you know, adjustments in the carts, and I buy the fictitious stuff, and there you go.
Yeah.
No one knows.
That's awesome. So in terms of like, you know, doing like blue green and things like that, you can kind of like roll services or applications out in either cloud and start hitting more and more of the one you're deploying in a different cluster. And because it's all on the same network, you'll still kind of, you can set it up so it round robins and might.
Absolutely. Both, right? Okay. Yeah. So everything that we've done, it's all Kubernetes native. So all the Kubernetes constructs apply, rolling updates, replica sets, the whole spiel.
And I think this is one of the solutions that actually will help me with the cloud bursting scenario where I don't want to like use up all the capacity or elasticity that I have in the cloud, but I want to have that option open. Mm. And if it's a slice that's pre-configured, come Black Friday, I just have to like ramp up my instances and then just spin up more pods.
Exactly.
That's awesome.
And so that's a use case we're doing with one of the large financial institutions. It's that exact use case.
Awesome.
Speaking of demoing, I feel like now, given the slice, and I talked about pizza before, there's got to be a demo in your future that has to be like selling pizza slices or something.
Oh, I know.
Or isn't there a slice app? Too. Isn't that like a real application, right, that like you can connect to? I've ordered pizza through it. I think so. I think there's a thing in the future there.
Yeah, I've used it plenty. Yeah. It's called Slice.
Okay. So, Rob, you mentioned that everything with KubeSlice is Kubernetes native. So how do we install it? Are there operators available? What does the installation workflow look like?
Yep. So you install it via Helm.
Yeah.
We have a KubeSlice CLI wrapper. So we create a topology file. You fill out the context of the clusters that you're trying to configure. Use that to install, and it'll install all the operators on all the clusters that are in that topology file.
Oh, perfect. And it like creates all the connections between the different clusters that are part of the slice.
Yep. You don't need to do a thing. Once it's done, it's all configured. Then you log into the UI, and from inside the UI, if you wanted to, right? You don't have to, but you can use the UI to create the slice, do the isolation, the resource quotas, all that fun stuff. If not, you can go to the YAML section of our documentation and create the slice config YAML if you want, and tailor it as you need to, and go through the normal constructs.
That's awesome. So, like, is this when you are seeing users and customers adopting this, right? Do you see this like developers doing this on self-service basis, or they're still relying on their network teams, quote unquote, to like, oh, please set up a slice for me. And then as a second half, I know it's a long question, but as a second part, right, can I integrate the slice construct in my CI/CD pipelines or my GitOps pipelines that I might have to deploy applications for a specific slice?
The answer is yes and yes.
Let's go. Cool.
The first half of it is it's really more of we're seeing the platform teams, right? And the larger enterprises, they want the control to create the slices, and they'll use whatever their normal, you know, ServiceNow or Jira tickets, whatever, to get the request to provision something. And some are also saying, yeah, we as a platform team, we can totally do that, but now we need to educate our internal developers on the freedom to deploy wherever they want now. So when they're making changes to their CI/CD pipelines and they're doing the redeploy on the slice, which clusters do they put those microservices?
Yeah, I think that's one thing. As we keep interviewing various people from around the industry, it's one thing we're seeing is it really depends on how much that organization has really adopted sort of that DevOps and sort of platform team, because the reality is it does vary, right? The unicorn would be, you know, one team knows all these things and can manage these things. But as we're asking, you know, one team to also know storage, also know networking, also know all these other things, I think that's a natural, to see a yes and yes scenario. So it's good to know. Speaking of those types of requirements, right, provisioning the network or a slice is one thing. But what about beyond that? How is that network secured? Does it also provide things like firewalling or network policies? You mentioned it was just L3, right? But does it help with other layers as well?
It does, yeah. So the L3 connectivity between the clusters, it's obviously encrypted. The slice construct itself is the isolation barrier. So we layer on network policies onto the slice at the slice level.
Okay.
That encompasses those namespaces. So if you already got network policies, great. It's just an additive policy already. So when you go into the UI, you click on, let's say you want to onboard a couple more namespaces for that application to communicate with. You create the policy, you apply it, and the UI does the rest.
Okay. Interesting. So I think, like, since you brought up UI a couple of times, right, I wanted to ask, like, is the UI component of KubeSlice also open source, or that's something that you have to pay for? Because we see other vendors in the ecosystem do that, right? Like, oh, the CLI thing is free, but then if you need a UI, it's paid. So I wanted to, like, start there, and then I have a follow-up question as well, Rob.
Sure, yeah, it's the latter. So the UI comes with the enterprise version.
Okay.
All the things that we're talking about, you can do with the open source piece. So the open source piece is the connectivity piece.
Yeah.
So if you want to do any of the other bells and whistles, the resource quotas on the slice, you know, graphically, you can do it, obviously, in Kubernetes constructs, right?
But
the automation in the UI is where that's at.
Okay, gotcha. And then I saw on your website, like when Rand and I were doing our research, KubeSlice also helps me with IP address management or IPAM. Is that a feature that's available in the open source one? How do I manage IP addresses across different clusters?
Yeah, so that the IP management piece is around that RFC 1918 address.
Yeah,
that's what it's inferring to. So if you've got that one, you don't have to do the bulk of the planning across all your different cloud providers and set up. Obviously, you have to do some to make sure that one that you choose does not conflict in your other sites.
Yeah.
And then you could repurpose it across all the slices.
Okay.
Or if you have a handful, right, you can just use a subset of them.
Okay. And how does it work with, like, CNI plugins? Do I need the same CNI plugin everywhere? Different CNI plugins will work
CNI on... CNI agnostic. So the way it actually works is under the covers, anything that's going on traffic wise and it's communicating in that local cluster, it uses the local CNI.
Oh, okay.
If it needed to talk to a service in another cluster, it's going to use the NSM interface, which is going over the tunnel to talk to the other cluster to get the information back. And then it routes it back through the CNI.
Gotcha.
To the server.
Like how does KubeSlice work with service meshes? I'm just thinking about the different scenarios, right? CNI transparent, that works. But if I as an organization, I'm already using Istio or something else from a service mesh perspective and enforcing or doing traffic routing, how does that work with KubeSlice?
Yeah, we say God bless you.
Okay, that's a fun answer.
Yeah, because we don't care. It has nothing to do. It does not change the slice behavior.
Okay.
So if you're already entrenched in Istio, you can certainly configure the slice to use Istio ingress and egress for your application. So nothing really changes there. And if we do have some customers that ask us, well, do I even need a, like if I'm going down this path, do I need a service mesh? And we say, well, you know, most of the time you're doing the service mesh for the intra-cluster traffic management, right? And we're more looking at the inter-cluster traffic management. So if you're using Istio in the mesh in your existing cluster, keep it if it's serving the purpose for you. It doesn't interfere with what we're trying to accomplish in the connectivity piece.
Gotcha. Got it. So you effectively have pods that are sort of dual honed to the network that is a slice and also to the rest of the Kubernetes cluster. Oh, yeah. Right. I'm just picturing this like weird Tron tunnel scenario in my head for some reason. But yeah, no, I think that's really powerful. You know, this show started off, we talked a lot about container storage because of Bob and I's background. And I did see a couple things around, specifically around databases, say running like Postgres or Mongo or CockroachDB, which even, you know, Cockroach being sort of a multi-cloud, multi-region sort of database as well. What can KubeSlice, I think, help with when running databases specifically? Because things get naturally a little more complicated when you start adding storage to the mix.
Yeah. So we have, if you go to our YouTube channel, well, you can do this at the end, but we have a video here where we're doing a demo with a Pac-Man application, right? And we're using MongoDB with three replica sets, and those replicas are across three different cloud providers. And so in that instance, we're showing the resiliency of having the application on the slice across the cloud providers, and we'll generally kill the pods that are running the DB service on the master and wherever it's running. And, you know, Mongo does its thing, does its etching, brings it back up, and the slice is none the wear. So when you go back to play the application in the front end, you'll see that the cloud provider changed, but the data that has all the historical high, like your high scores, is still intact. So it helps by, you know, allowing you to distribute that your databases across the cloud providers and not having to do anything necessarily special that they already do.
Okay. So you can have essentially replicas of each of those types of databases in different regions or clouds and let them do their typical application level replication over the network, but doesn't stop you from using something like storage or volumes or PPCs underneath locally to keep things safe as well. Okay.
Correct.
Interesting. And okay, that's a good use case. My point goes to like, are people actually doing that? That's like a really complicated setup, right?
When you Mom have hope so.
Yeah. we actually created this demo because one of the large financial institutions in Toronto, the big one over there, this was stemmed from their use case.
Okay.
Like we've got these Mongo replicas all over the place and we need to protect the data. So if, you know, even if it's on-prem, right? So if they wanted to be able to safeguard their data and if something goes bump in the night, that there's no interruptions to the transactions.
Gotcha.
Makes sense. I mean, I always think back to, I don't even know when this use case occurred, but the Netflix, you know, Cassandra use case, where they had those things kind of everywhere on those rings. Anyway, we didn't talk about Cassandra, but you could just, you know, people have been doing these types of, I think, architectures. Yeah. And now I think the more people are deploying them, yeah, you know, on Kubernetes, with these things are just necessities that come as part of, hey, I want to do this architecture for availability or something.
And in that same data vein, we're seeing customers that are coming out of the woodwork, especially around their Kafka clusters, right? So having distributed, they're having a hard time doing distributive Kafka across cloud providers. Right. So they can have multiple, you know, Kafka clusters wherever they are in AWS, but getting them to talk to each other, either cross region, what have you, is difficult. So they're trying to, that's one of the next demos we're trying to put out there, is doing multiple Kafka clusters across different cloud providers on the slice and having it stream its data through using both, you know, the resources from both clusters.
So is that like a broker would be replicating?
Correct.
Externally, I forget the actual terminology in Kafka land, but
it is broker. Yeah.
That's awesome. And Ryan, thank you for bringing up Cassandra. Right, I just remembered when you were talking, like Kate Sandra, the operator, actually now supports deploying Cassandra instances across different geographies. And then, but in their documentation, they're like, you have to take care of networking. If all the clusters can talk to each other, we can deploy it, and this just fits perfectly. So it's awesome.
Yeah, at the very beginning, I think we did the same thing with Postgres. Like before we had all the UI and all the fancy stuff, that was one of the first demos, right? Just doing a Postgres replication across on the slide, across different cloud providers. And it was great.
Gotcha. And I think I want to talk about a bit about like auto-scaling, right? I know we spoke about cloud bursting. How does, like, can KubeSlice help me with specifying any auto-scaling rules? If I'm moving things around to a different cluster inside the slice, can I scale up the worker nodes, things like that? Can AI, the new buzzword, play any role in that?
Yeah, does it? So KubeSlice, no. We have a second product called SmartScaler for that.
Okay.
So we SmartScaler does exactly what you say. We have an RL-based AI engine that learns the application behavior, and it will set the configuration for your HPA autoscaler now constantly over time. So you won't have to go into every single one of your clusters for all those particular workloads and set the minimum and maximum thresholds and waste time and money, right? So the goal there with SmartScaler is really about the savings.
Yeah.
So we've seen in some of the training models that we have anywhere up to almost 70% savings on the cluster. And so we're going to be modest. Let's just say it's 35. Right? Even 35% savings is great. And the other thing that we kind of tout around SmartScaler is now you can actually offer your users SLOs against that, where before you can't. And then, of course, it's around really around the cost save. Right? If you're just willy-nilly spinning up pods, like to your case, like Black Friday, I'm gonna burst into the cloud, but I'm going to have my autoscaler set to however many thousands of pods because I don't know. Right, it's back in the AWS days when Black Friday came around. We had to talk to the customers and say, "Hey, we noticed the data from last year. We need to warm all your EC2 instances underneath and get them ready." Right, so we could do all that fun stuff. It's in the same concept, but now you know it's predictive AI that's doing it.
Nice. I like. Are we in that part of the advancement of these technologies where we're allowed to say back in the AWS days?
I feel like
the reality is, I think we think that way, given the where technology is going and kind of where we want it to go. But I just had to key in on that.
Even now they've changed that even at AWS, right? There's no more pre-warming. They kind of, you know, figured all that out. But
So we say OG at AWS days, maybe.
Yeah. OG, for sure.
So, you know, we've seen other applications and platforms do similar things in terms of using, AI or models to kind of help different aspects of running Kubernetes platforms, whether that be cost or kind of monitoring or even troubleshooting. Does the autoscaler piece or the SmartScaler piece tap into the KubeSlice networks to know what's going on at all? Or like, where does it get its metrics or data from?
So it's pulling its metrics from Prometheus.
Okay.
So it's taking all the Prometheus metrics, and that's what they're using to train the model. Or if you're using Datadog, it'll pull your Datadog metrics from all the clusters and collate it and do its algorithms based on that for the traffic prediction.
Yeah. Right. And Prometheus being so widely, I think, used, that's, so you have Prometheus, Datadog, any others that I think are supported out there? Or
Right now, off the top of my head, it's those two.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, if you Prometheus, you got probably 80% of the market, right? Yeah. I would imagine. I have that. There's no basis in my percentages right there, but
that's the power of having a podcast, Ryan. You can make claims. Yeah.
And the feature for that too, that they're developing based on some feedback from a customer, was they want to have the ability to do like scheduling via the calendar.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. So let's say you know Black Friday is coming, then you know it's based on calendar events. Or the use case is really around like an online betting retailer. They're like, we cannot lose any data. There can be no disruption whatsoever.
Yeah.
So if, you know, a fight's coming out, as simple as that, right? There's going to be a fight. Let's say it was the Musk and Zuckerberg fight, right? And you're putting,
I'd watch.
And you're going to put bets on it, right? They don't want to lose not a dollar from that.
I know.
So they want to use that kind of that feature to make sure they're scheduling it based on what the events are.
Gotcha.
And that, do we know that's not happening, or is there?
Yeah, I think that's not happening. They publicly
because I would have paid that pay per view. Yeah. I would pay for that.
We can just pay for the Super Bowl. Like the gambling company doesn't want to lose any bets during a Super Bowl. Let's say.
There you go. Well, speaking of use cases, do you have some really good use cases that you could talk about? You don't have to mention names or anything like that. I know you've mentioned a few already, but any favorites that come to mind that would be kind of useful?
The only one I think I haven't mentioned was, we had a large retailer that they're in a precarious situation for pop-up stores, especially during the summer. Uh-huh. Where getting the connectivity from whatever that location may be and connecting it to the back end, it would just take too long. Mm-hmm. For them to do it. So we came up with I called it the Edge Stack.
Yeah.
Edge Stack Retail Accelerator. So we basically took some Novo Nooks.
Mm-hmm. Oh, nice.
Right? And then we installed Kubernetes on the Nooks.
Nice.
And then we connected those Nooks to their back-end Kubernetes OMS systems and all that fun stuff. So now there's a mesh. I don't want to use the word mesh. Now there's connectivity between the pop-up store and their back-end. Okay. Seamlessly. And so they also had problems, and we partnered with Cox Edge around this. Okay. Because we needed that last mile of connectivity. Right. So they their big problem was, you know, they do some pop-up stores, let's say here in New York City. Yep. And some of the buildings are so old that they can't get reliable internet. So they end up having to rent trucks, put the antenna on the damn roof, and then run all the cabling down so they can operate the pop-up store. And the other use case for that same retailer was around space in the retail stores. Like, so if you go into any high-end retailer, any retailer really, right? You go in the back and there's a server rack in there.
Yeah.
With a switch. Yep. And some other stuff. And so in pop-up stores, having that space, it's a loss, right? Mm-hmm. They need to have merchandise in there so they can sell. So having just this underneath the counter at the end where they're doing the POS point of view or the POS checkouts, mm-hmm. no space, so they could get more square footage to do what they need to do.
Got it. So that basically that point of sale software is running sort of at the edge closest to where these pop-ups happen and kind of provide that front end connectivity back to where
if we want to, like the full solution was three parts. It was KubeSlice, Cox Edge for the edge location. And then we also partnered with SpectroCloud. So they did the Kubernetes management
stack.
And we were able to stack all the corporation's applications into the blueprint or the pancake, which you call it. And so when we deployed it, it did all its configurations on your own, which kind of alludes back to your CI/CD question. So yes, since it's, you know, native Kubernetes commands, you just do whatever you need to do.
Very cool. I mean, all this talk about slices and pancakes, I'm getting hungry.
I got some pizza in the fridge, actually.
Why is there always a connection between technology and food? But I'm not disliking it. But I think this has been a super powerful conversation. I think there's so much, I think, in the networking space, especially I think if you're new to Kubernetes, a lot of things can be complicated, but the networking side of things might be one of the tougher ones to really wrap your head around, right? Just because there's at a base level without adding more overlays on top of of networks, I think coming out with new solutions that drive simplicity has to be sort of at the front, right?
Yeah, and so mentioning on that note, Evisha themselves, they're now in the Gartner hype cycle.
Okay.
They put us into the new one is for Kubernetes networking for, mm-hmm. you know, zero trust networking and the hype cycle for container technology. And then the other one was for the programmable platform. Nice. So same thing for infrastructure strategy and, you know, data center infrastructure technology. So it's starting to pick up more and more, and hopefully that utopia of deploy your application anywhere, we're able to help those customers do that.
Got with it, the drawn tunnels in between, I guess.
Yeah. <That's awesome>.
Yeah. Okay. I guess, Rob, one more question, right? I think you brought up a lot of demos. Are there communities that our listeners can join, places where they can find these demos, getting started guides, anything that you want to link or give a call out to?
So if you go to avisha.io and then go to the documentation section, that'll bring you to the enterprise documentation. Mm-hmm. There we have a link for a playground. So if you just want a playground, we have a bunch of kind clusters set up and you can go through and peruse around. There's also a quick start guide also. So if you wanted to try it in your own environment, we give a 30-day free trial license. Go ahead, download it, install it, play with it, break it. If you needed support, you can go to support.avisha.io. Put in a ticket. And if you're interested in the open source version, that's kubeslice.io.
Okay.
And then we're also in the Kubernetes Slack ecosystem. So if you're already part of the Kubernetes Slack workspace, you can just go to the hashtag kubeslice channel.
Okay.
And talk to the rest of the community users there.
Great. Great. And will you be at KubeCon Chicago yourself?
I don't know if they're going to send me. I'm pretty sure there'll be a cohort of some kind.
Yeah. Nice.
But I may or may not be there. I hope to be.
Well, whether it's you or not, Bob and I usually do some live shows on the floor. So if there's someone you'd be interested about talking to us again, we usually do sort of smaller 15-minute sort of conversations, but then we jam them all together for some KubeCon episodes. We'd love to get an update for kind of what you guys are up to.
Yeah, that'd be great.
As well. All right, so time for ChatGPT question segment. Sure. So I mentioned earlier that the question would be if networking in Kubernetes were a superhero, what would it be? And you can give your best answer, or I can let you know what ChatGPT says, which is quite funny, actually.
Well, if it was smart, it would say KubeSlice for sure.
Nice.
It gave the superpower. It gave the superhero the name of Connectron or NetWeaver. I don't know. It gave two. I don't know why it gave two.
You know what's funny? Didn't I think HashiCorp used NetWeaver under the cover for its reconciliator?
Maybe they got it from here, or maybe it got it from here. The superpower it says here would be seamless and dynamic networking, and I won't give you all the I'll give you the brief intro to its super abilities. Would be a teleconnect, net weaving, firewall manipulation, traffic shaping, subspace messaging. I'm not even sure what to do with that one, and a resilience aura against things like DDoS attacks, and its arch nemesis, the latency lurker.
Nice. It's just weird that it's making new characters up. I would have just gone with like Spider-Man. I don't know, helping connect things with the net. That's it.
I was gonna say there needs to be some t-shirts made out of that one. We can make some t-shirts.
Yeah.
I didn't even mention it. I didn't mention this this Connectron superhero has a battle cry. It goes like this: forge the digital web, unite the code. I don't know why it chose that phrase, nice. But there's its battle cry. Apparently has very little to do with networking, I think, but
yeah.
Hey.
Depends on who you ask.
Oh, man. Well, Rob, it's been a pleasure having you on the show, and hopefully we'll talk to you again soon. Otherwise, take care.
You too. Thanks, fellas. Thanks again.
Thanks, Rob.
All right. Well, that finishes up our conversation with Rob. I think the entire networking space around Kubernetes, like I was saying in our conversation, is a really complex one.
Yep.
I started, like I said, my roots in sort of this networking space. And just if you were to take Kubernetes, vanilla Kubernetes, and try to dive into the networking side of things and CNIs and how the cluster IPs work versus external IPs versus load balancing and all these things. It's quite a complex space. Yeah. So I do like, the simplicity of the multi-cluster kind of kube slice technology that it seems to be kind of targeting, because it's already a huge space. So I don't know. What did you take out of this conversation, Bob?
Again, I really liked the conversation because I don't know of any other solution right now, right? Like, obviously I can do some research and find that out, but this is an interesting problem to solve and an actual problem to solve instead of just making shit up. I think this was a real thing, like a real challenge. As I said on the episode, right? I have configured, like for VM-based workloads, I've configured like the Cisco routers on-prem and in the cloud and created these VPN tunnels, and it took a lot of time. And if we want developers to have the agility and set up multi-cluster, multi-cloud things, we can't wait a couple of weeks to configure the tunnels between two clusters. Having something like KubeSlice create that slice construct definitely helps, makes multi-cloud easy, makes hybrid cloud easy. So I really like that part. I also like the fact that most of what we spoke about today was open source. I know the UI thing, I was glad that we clarified that piece. Like the UI for it is an enterprise thing, but if you just want to deploy KubeSlice on your own using YAML files and the Helm chart, it's all open source, KubeSlice.io.
As well, yeah.
Yeah. So those were like a couple of my key takeaways.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point around the complexity of kind of creating these networks. And we didn't really talk about underlay networks right, at all in this episode. But the reality of it is none of that really goes away, right? There's still a lot of kind of base connectivity and there's still a lot that goes on in that space. Yeah. But when you get to the point of this, you know, again, abstractions are key when you're kind of working at the level of these types of Kubernetes namespaces and slices, being able to kind of click a button and connect two clusters is super powerful.
Yeah.
You know, given that you already have the rest of that connectivity in place for those clusters to talk to each other. Now you can just make your applications seamlessly be able to discover each other and talk to each other. I think it's super powerful. As we mentioned earlier in the intro, multi-cluster is definitely something companies are thinking about and releasing new projects and products around. So I think we're going to see that more and more as time goes on. So for me, right, I think an interesting point is that migration is still a leading kind of use case that Rob still uses when he talks to customers. I think this definitely shows that as we talk to these guests on the show, we often talk about kind of leading edge things, but the reality of it is tons of people are still, you know, moving to this type of technology, moving to Kubernetes, and still really thinking about that migration use case about how do I get the workloads that I have here that we've been testing and, you know, dabbling with Kubernetes into these different spaces or different clouds now that we want to start using them. So I think that was just an interesting point that was not so surprising, but really validating, I guess, to hear for me, and just kind of shows you that a technology like networking doesn't stop at just, you know, connectivity and discovering of services. It has other things that you can obviously use it for in test, dev, staging, those kind of things. Nice. Cool. Well, that was a fun show. And I think that brings us to the end of today's episode, Bhavan. So I'm Ryan.
I'm Bhavan.
And thanks for joining another episode of Kubernetes Bytes.
Thank you for listening to the Kubernetes Bytes podcast.